Hello from David Rutledge. Welcome to the Earshot podcast. When the first wave of Greek immigrants came to Australia in the 1950s and 60s, they came with a strong sense of their origins, where they were coming from, but a lot less certainty about what their new homeland might have in store for them. Well, since then, for some, in spite of decades in Australia, Greece has always exerted a very strong pull. But for their children, the second generation Greek Australians, questions of identity and belonging are a lot more ambiguous. Well, in a recent collection of verse entitled Southern Sun, Aegean Light, editor Nick Trakakis has gathered work from second-gen Greek-Australian poets, and they're challenging a lot of assumptions about who they are.
The Sea Urchin by Effie Hadzimanoli. We sit on the yellow spines of the summer grass, gathered around my new aunt with her late summer harvest on the beach. She's recently arrived from the Peloponnese, as confident as anything about the sea. She cups the sea urchins and cradles the octopus. And then, like a sick cat, she eats the bitter wild greens collected by the other women. It's my last summer before I start school. Before her suicide. I see how she cracks open the sea urchin, its orange water soaking the newspaper grey, and how she smiles, delicately. I want to taste the sea urchin. But my mother stops me sternly. There's not enough to go around. My mother's eyes are wide as saucers. I know she's aghast at the foreign thing she's been offered. As if it's auntie's human flesh she's expecting to consume.
I'm Effie Hatzmanolis. I am a writer. I write poetry, experimental prose. I was an academic for many years. I still think of myself as an intellectual writer. I was born in Wollongong. I've lived here for most of my life, but I've worked in Sydney. And I actually moved to England. And at that time, while in England, I started to write poetry and also started to write about being actually a second-generation immigrant Australian. And it was interesting that that happened in England.
Prayer at Midnight by Nicholas Kyriakos. They are the source of my creating, these moments of darkened thoughts, when my hoarse voice, lingering in this vacuum, this box, discourses with itself, fragments of a soul, not entirely believed in, wrenched forth then given form, a useless goal, going nowhere, words of pretension scratched upon this barren page. Oh my God, if you believe in yourself, if an emptied heart is to engage its fill, save me from myself.
My name is Nick Trakakis. I'm the editor of the book Southern Sun, Aegean Light, Poetry of Second Generation Greek Australians. But if anything, what this collection tries to do is to show how flawed and vague these kind of categorizations are. So no one is ever just a Greek Australian. They're also, you know, a father, a mother, a daughter, a son, all sorts of other things come into it. I wouldn't first and foremost consider myself as a Greek Australian poet or a Greek Australian writer. I think it's the poetry, the writing that comes first.
Inheritance by Nick Trakakis. Wherever I go, whatever I do, I carry within me my father. That look, that sigh of one thrown into an alien land, without hope of returning home, for home has ceased to exist. Wherever I go, Whatever I do, I carry within me my mother. That look, that sigh, of a little girl with double-plaited hair, stranded on an outer village hilltop, amidst violent rain, crying and weeping, having just heard of the murder of her father. This is my inheritance.
Well, my name is Helen Nikas. I studied as a mature age student at the University of Melbourne, thanks to Gough Whitlam and his government, but also feminism. The feminist movement helped me in the 70s to feel confident enough to do something that I hadn't been able to do before. Because I came in the 60s as a young girl, having just finished high school. So then I studied at Melbourne University. I did English literature as well as Greek studies and decided to become a publisher as well. First generation writers know who they are. They are Greek. They were born in Greece. They came to Australia as immigrants. So for them, identity is a very clear thing. And they, most of them wrote in Greek anyway. So they were, as far as language went and themes and everything was about Greece, the country they came from. So it was very clear cut. And for me teaching it as well, that was the case. But then when it comes to second generation, well, it's different because second generation, what do we mean by that? We mean the offspring of Greek immigrants and also those who were born in Australia and those who also came as very, very young children. Tom Petsinis, Peter Lisiotis, they came when they were 3 or 4 years old. So we count them as second generation as well, because they write in English. So the first thing is that they all write in English, except one or two exceptions who chose to write in Greek, a little bit like Kavafi in Alexandria in Egypt, who wrote in Greek, even though he had hardly ever been to Greece. So most of them write in English. They have problems with identity, in a way, because to begin with, they wanted to be part of Australia. They wanted to say, I'm an Australian, even though my background is Greek. They had that to deal with at first. So a lot of them didn't even want to say that they were Greek. They said, that's irrelevant for us. You know, we're just writers like everyone else.
Widows of the Sun by Chrysoula Simos. Dressed in mourning black, they stand in silent doorways, their eyes craters webbed with cataracts. Widows of the sun. Their faces lined with ancient maps of lost worlds, they stare beyond the blackened cliffs and the hidden fires of the sea. When daylight palls, they sit on the whitewashed porches and speak with ragged voices of memories and legends, weaving the night with the brittle threads of the past and the visions of an island risen from a dream.
That as time went and Greeks of that generation became more confident, they also grew up, they were in their 40s and early 50s, they started to feel, I want to go back to our roots. Where did my family come from? What was life like in Greece? Because some of them went there as tourists and the impression is not the same as when, you know, you go to look at where your parents came from, the villages especially where they came from and that kind of thing. And then they started to feel that they needed to reconnect with their roots, a lot of these Greek Australian writers. So they were not embarrassed anymore. They felt confident Yes, I'm an Australian, but my background is Greek, and I want to write about that. And for me personally, I felt that that was very important because they were writing the history of Greek migration in Australia, or generally migration in Australia. And I found that very interesting, and I also found that women were very, very confident about writing about their family, their mothers, their grandparents, describing them in their poetry or their prose. And there's an abundance of women now. In the last 20 years, there are a lot of women writing. It's the exact opposite now. The first generation had more male writers, and the second generation has almost more women writers.
Mind by Salome Argyropoulou. What to do? Where to go? Am I doing the right thing? Will tomorrow be a good day? Mind like a mad monkey alights on each new thought for a moment till the next one comes along and holds its attention. Like a butterfly, it flutters from one flower to another, ceaselessly going nowhere but circling the same unkempt garden over and over again. How to stop this senseless round of the mind's cecity? Just be still and know that thou art.
Peter Lisiotis. I write, I make books, I make photographs. My passion, I guess, is books. It's interesting, this thing of words and language, because I spent my youth, when I came to Australia after I was 4 years old, up in the Wimmera. And it wasn't so much words and language that distinguished the three or four Greek families in Horsham from the rest. It was surface things like the way the young men would walk down Fibrace Street, neatly pressed trousers. That looked something like the Reservoir Dogs guys. And it was in the gestures, in the look. It was totally different. I mean, the language, I guess, wasn't as clearly heard because it was almost whispered. You know, the Greek words were whispered between Greeks and within the Greek family and within the confines of those three or four families there.
The Bird in the Bell Tower by Peter Lisiotis. On the bell tower, the wind breaks like glass. At the edge of the bell tower, there is a bird wet with light. It has black wings as in miracles. But the sound of the bell holds the bird to the bell tower. Everything is held the way it was agreed upon years ago.
As you become more aware of the everyday, of your everyday, and the people that you meet and that you love, that's when you begin to find your own voice. It's when you find your own people, in a sense, the people that are important to you. And I think those two things go hand in hand. You do learn to trust yourself, but that doesn't mean that you abandon the guides that, you know, saw you through things, like even the two Dylans, Dylan Thomas and Bob Dylan, or whether it was reading The Wasteland for the first time. you don't abandon that, you just integrate it, and it's one of the rocks that you cling to like a periwinkle, I guess, in the end. But you never abandon it. There's that line in Proof Rock. Eliot writes, you know, my life has been measured out in coffee spoons. Well, I've carried that line with me, and I thought, you know, you should be able to do something with this. And I know that every Greek migrant that's ever come to Australia has measured out their lives with a lemon tree in the backyard. And I wanted, in the end, to write something that was Proof Rock-like and Eliot-like, but also Greek and simple and sing-songy enough. So I came up with this, which is called 32 Davis Street, East Burwood. The last word my mother spoke left a small...
The last word my mother spoke left a small black hole in the air outside her kitchen window, just above the lemon tree. It's still there.
And I love that poem because of the way he describes the persistence, the shaping influence of the mother's word. It's as if her absence is present, and it implies a sort of mother tongue that persists, and that it shapes and it influences the surviving generation, the second generation immigrant. And where does it persist? It's a hole just above the lemon tree. That image of the lemon tree for a Greek first generation and second generation is so evocative. Greeks talk about lemon trees the way Italians talk about, I don't know, basil. Intense pleasure and great love.
Peloponnese Sunset by Angela Costi. How can you be lonely? You make love to this environment. The hills have slopes you can swoon on. They have views you can open your thighs to. They have Venetian structures ready for you to take with one open gasp. They have seas that melt your gaze the colour of lilac if it was blue. And black crosses on white churches. Reminders of sacred sensuousness. Reminders of honey-skinned almond eyes, a touch of madness and of chance.
The Man Who Knew to Smile by Nicholas Kyriakos. The flip-flop of the battered saveloy striking the side of the pot. Fat sizzling in the open-mouthed vat. Two boys watching their papa. Their legs swinging off the ground. Two rickety chairs dancing in the back room of the shop. Papa stops, smiles, lightens the afternoon, continues his fish shop business. The boys now men. Their own children and women playing games on the sunset lawn. The men, now boys, battering fish. The banter of brothers causing pots and fry pans to giggle when one of their own enters, striding, shouting in his little boy's voice, "You swing me on the swing, Papa," as he clumsily mounts a wooden stool. Where are memories stored to well forth decades hence? Who dies that brings forth tears in one's adult sons, now grown to one's own age? Two brothers in a kitchen, weeping for the man who always knew to stop to smile.
Education, that was the route to take. I mean, for myself, I was, I attended a selective high school, and I also worked in my father's fish and chip shop on the weekends. In the days when newspapers were used to wrap up the fish and chips. And before those newspapers were wrapped up, I used to buy the Australian every Saturday on the weekend. And I was introduced to Greek-Australian writing through The Australian in the 70s. It's where I first read Antigone Kefalo's work. It was published in those pages. And I wrapped Fish and Chips up with Antigone Kefalo's work as well. But there was no idea of shutting me up in any way because I was a woman. My family have always been interested in art and culture in quite traditional ways. We're talking about rhyming nationalistic Greek poetry. I was made to attend Greek school as a child. By the time I was 12, I could recite these Greek nationalistic poems, and I often didn't know what they meant. I had no idea what they meant because they were actually in Katharevousa, a language I didn't speak at home. Working class Greeks spoke Demotika and came from a background of great disruption, Second World War, starvation, followed by civil war and migration. So they were great productive forces. I don't see them as limiting forces, actually. But they encouraged an interest in literature across different languages. But they did something else which I think is really sort of central to thinking about the contributions of second-generation immigrant writers and the first generation, which is that they made us aware that when we spoke as second-generation immigrants, or if we were seen as speaking like that, that we were involved in a struggle with stereotypes about our voices. And stereotypes are sticky. They are so sticky. They stick to your body, they stick to your writing, to your body of work. And the struggle with those stereotypes in the writings of the second generation immigrants is wonderful because it takes on those stereotypes and it mocks them.
I Hate Hate by Luca Haralampu. I'm angry at the powers that be, the powers that endeavour to disempower me, the powers that dismember society's members and amputate our collective memories. I'm angry at the invisible, the inept, the incomprehensibly in debt, definitely in denial of the dictatorship's deaths. I'm angry at the bastards behind their desks, contributing to cacophonies of courageless Cronulla cowards quick to cast a cord towards a colonizer's crest. I'm angry at the spies, at the people who taught you lies. I'm angry that you were in no place to invite my ancestors who arrived and that they had to be white. I'm angry that when we landed, you then called us all black, kept us fearful of our enemies and wonder why we always look back. I'm angry at the people who pretend to be people, steeples pretending to be steeples, priests who pretend to protect, and that we all have a need now to pretend to respect. I'm pissed off at epistemological lies, lives lying in light, liable to be lively only after large litres of lager at night. I'm pissed off that good men won't stand up, they're too drunk on capitalist charms and advertising jingles calling themselves funk, punk, junk. I hate it when rappers put ads in their music. They hold the sacred power of the message and they choose to abuse it. No more bitches, money and more guns, snitches, honeys, Air Force Ones. I'm sick of all these endorsements. They promote nothing but sex and wonder why they need more love. I hate how much they hate, and I hate how much they taught me to hate, branding every white person as a member of the KKK. This is stupid. Did we choose this? This was music. Words are useless. I'm angry that I'm angry. I hate that I hate. I hate that I hate that I hate. I hate hate.
When I'm writing in English, I'm hearing words that I'm using in English but also in Greek. And if their sound convinces me in Greek that they're the right words to use, then I'll go with it. But if they remain dry and flat as air, then I won't use them. if the word doesn't work for me in one of the two languages that I know, then it doesn't get committed to paper.
The Lucky Country by George Athanasiou. Migrating from a cafe to a bar. We didn't wander far to find a comfortable place to stay. It was getting close to the end of a long day. But when they told us they were out and that we had to wait 15 minutes for the next bout of hot water, we just moved on. And someone remembered Ithaca and Ulysses, from Homer's Odyssey to the Iliad, then to Cavafy, and though Sepphoris and Elitus didn't get a mention, Alfred Nobel gave them something more that brought their lives and literature to the fore. Theodorakis followed Manos Hadjidakis, and the Zorba did for Greek music what Zed did for Gavras, and Maria Callas showed us the quality of her voice, while Aliki and Carezi gave a cinema of choice, and then there was Michael Kakoyannis, director of Stella and The Girl in Black. Do we really want to go back? Our parents often thought about returning when they first came to this land called Xenitia. They were always yearning, while we were at school learning. They worked in factories and on railroads, when fish and chip shops were all the rage, and the milk bar was the supermarket of their age. Working 5, 6, or 7 days a week, they were proud to say that they were Greek. What's become of the sunburnt country? The lucky country. An economy that was raised on the sheep's back. A multicultural melting pot. A mask that promotes assimilation. One nation. Globalization. Cultural assassination. Just wait another generation.
And in this Earshot podcast, you've been listening to Southern Sun, Aegean Light, poems by second-generation Greek Australians. Head to the Earshot website for details of the poets featured and the anthology of verse from which today's readings were taken. The program was produced by Michael Sheriffs and the sound engineer was Gary Havrillay. And this has been RN's Earshot podcast. I'm David Rutledge. Thanks for your company. Bye for now.